This is Radio Equalshock with your host, Alex Smith.
Humanity is finally turning away from fossil fuels. With growing climate awareness and warnings from top scientists, big money is divesting from oil, gas, and coal projects. That is good news for our threatened future, except none of it is true. Fossil fuel production and carbon emissions continue to balloon beyond record levels, despite green commitments from presidents, prime ministers, and kings. In war, peace, and pandemic, the carbon machine pours on more greenhouse gases into the sky. Lauren Stockman is the research co-director at Oil Change International. He specializes in the North American oil industry. Lauren previously produced research and reports for Greenpeace UK while campaigning for climate action. He holds a master's degree from King's College London and co-authored the book The Next Gulf, about oil and conflict in Africa. From Washington, D.C., Lauren Stockman, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, great to be here.
Of course, world attention has swung from pandemic to the invasion of Ukraine. It's like a big spotlight. So why worry about energy and climate change at a time like this?
Well, I mean, obviously, climate change is one of the biggest planetary crises that we face. And I don't think anyone can have missed in the recent years the wildfires, the floods, the extreme weather, the increasing severity of storms, and the increasing frequency of severe storms. We do have some pretty serious short-term crises on our hands today with what's going on in Eastern Europe. You know, climate change remains the biggest long-term existential threat.
Russia supplied about 10% of world gas and oil, almost half of Europe's gas. Do you think this war in the Ukraine will stimulate even more fossil fuel projects in the United States trying to make money by filling the gap?
Unfortunately, I do think that's what the industry is certainly pushing for. I think that's pretty clear. We've seen some representatives of the American Petroleum Institute and other industry representatives getting on into the media and using this as an opportunity. We're certainly getting mixed signals from the Biden administration. I think there are certainly things that can be done in the short term to ensure some energy security for European consumers. But I do think it's very, very dangerous to presume that this crisis is a reason to invest in additional long-lived infrastructure to deliver fossil fuels to Europe. I think that would be not only a grave risk in terms of how that would lock in fossil fuels and make climate change worse, but also I think that would be a big risk from an investor perspective, because we're seeing an energy transition that is accelerating very fast. And it's clear that fossil fuels, on a global level, they're abundant in some parts of the world and they're not so abundant in others, and that we're never going to escape from that problem. So kind of locking in more fossil fuels as a solution to the current crisis would not actually be an energy security strategy.
The United Nations Panel on Climate Change called an emergency last year. Even the International Energy Agency, usually a booster, finally admitted we need to stop expanding oil, gas, and coal. But Lauren, what do you see really happening?
Well, unfortunately, we do see the industry responding to these short-term signals. You know, some parts of the industry still continuing to kind of push a kind of climate denial message or to offer solutions to climate change and to fossil fuel emissions that aren't real solutions, i.e. full solutions like carbon capture and storage, manufacturing hydrogen by using fossil gas and trying to bury the emissions from that so-called blue hydrogen. You know, some parts of the industry kind of carrying on business as usual, and then other parts of the industry that are more public-facing and are more concerned about their reputation, like the big oil majors, the big names that we know, like BP, Shell, Exxon, etc., starting to put forward these full solutions that continue fossil fuel use, but under this kind of myth of carbon capture and storage, which to date has been a very big expensive failure.
Yes, Shell Oil has done exactly that in Alberta, Canada. They've put on what they call carbon capture and storage as they produce hydrogen. And they say that will allow people to keep burning gas for generations to come. And for me, that's chilling. That's just a disaster in the making.
Yeah, I think that's right, because the track record of carbon capture and storage today has been very, very poor. A lot of projects fail to meet the goals that they've set. They don't capture nearly as much of the carbon that they claim that they will do when the project's proposed. They've sucked up billions and billions in government subsidies, and now they're asking for more because surely it will work this time if we plow more money into it. And they're also ignoring the other impacts. Even if the capture rate of carbon dioxide improves and they succeed in doing what the projects are designed to do, we still have the many impacts for local communities, for environmental justice communities, you know, the communities that have historically borne the brunt of the industry's pollution and environmental destruction. So if anything, these projects, they require a lot of energy. So more, you know, if you're going to capture the emissions from, say, a gas-fired power plant or some other industrial facility that's using gas, you've got to use more gas to run the equipment that does the carbon capture piece. So if anything, these projects are threatening to increase the impact of the fossil fuel industry on our planet.
Well, there is a thing in psychology called cognitive dissonance, and that's where you have to hold two conflicting ideas in your head. And this whole fossil fuel world is just full of them. I mean, at the COP26 in Scotland, U.S. President Joe Biden said the science is clear. We need to limit global warming. It's a great challenge. But didn't Biden just approve a bunch of new oil and gas drilling leases in the Gulf?
Well, that's right. They did go ahead with that sale. And actually, since then, that lease sale in the Gulf of Mexico has been overturned by a federal court. So it remains to be seen what actually happens with that sale. I'm sure the industry is going to attempt to overturn that decision. What's clear is that the Biden, you know, is being pulled into two directions, and it hasn't shown that it's fully committed to the promises it made in Glasgow by continuing with those lease sales. And also it's pushing for solutions like carbon capture through the Department of Energy. It hasn't fully recognized the role of U.S. LNG exports and has not committed to putting the current crisis in Europe aside and the kind of short-term actions they might be taking there. They haven't really committed to stop expanding U.S. LNG capacity. Right. And, you know, as you permit new LNG plants, those plants take years to finance and build. So projects that have only recently been permitted or are about to be permitted, they may not be actually operational for five or more years from now. And that has nothing to do with the current situation in Europe and threatens to lock in emissions for decades and decades from dirty fossil gas. So we have seen some positive action from the Biden administration. And also from Congress in the infrastructure bill, there is some serious funding for helping the U.S. economy transition to cleaner fuels. But at the same time, there's funding for things like carbon capture. There's still a reluctance to definitively call an end to fossil fuel expansion in this country.
Yes, the U.S. Energy Information Administration forecasts American oil and gas production could break a record this year because of higher prices. But I think the disconnect is the public doesn't realize you can't produce more oil and gas without producing more global warming gases, without causing more tremendous storms and fires and droughts and all heat. We lost 600 people to the heat effect last summer right here in British Columbia, in Canada. It was a shocker. So we need to make that connection. If you go and make more of it, more people are going to die and go through suffering.
Well, I think that's right. And I think that realization, there has been somewhat of a sea change in realizing the threat of climate change among the U.S. public. But, we, you know, we have a fundamental structural issue in U.S. governance on issues like this. It comes down to the tremendous power of the fossil fuel lobby on Capitol Hill and in state capitals, their ability to be able to finance the campaigns of politicians that support what they're doing. And Oil Change International, we were founded in 2005 with a campaign that basically looked at the money in and the money out. The money in was the campaign finance. We built a database tracking the companies and members of the U.S. House and Senate and how much they were receiving from fossil fuel companies. And then we documented the money out, which is the subsidies, the production subsidies, the tax breaks, the royalty breaks, the tax loopholes, that some of which have been in existence for over 100 years in the U.S. for oil and gas producers. So we've been highlighting that issue for over 15 years now. We've made some progress. We've seen the Biden administration call an end to international finance, so kind of development aid finance that it was giving to oil and gas projects abroad. It's not perfect, but it's certainly a start, and we're pushing very hard to remove the domestic subsidies for the oil and gas industry. That's one of the kind of crucial structural flaws in the American system that makes it very difficult for climate policy to be enacted at the level that it should be. And I don't think you can see a kind of clearer example of that than what happened in the Senate with Joe Manchin from West Virginia and his blocking of the Build Back Better Act, which had significant funding for clean energy transition in that bill. So these are the kind of structural challenges that we face in the U.S. in trying to get change. I believe we are making progress there, but we need to be fighting a lot harder, and we need elected officials that are prepared to stand up to the fossil fuel industry. You know, I would also mention we've had a number of pushes to get delegates and people running for office to forswear fossil fuel money, no fossil fuel money pledge. And we need more people to come forward and run for office under that banner of running for climate action and for people and not for the fossil fuel lobby.
This is a climate emergency. Find out more on the blog, ecoshock.org. No sign up, just the latest info, free for all. Ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. Our guest is Lauren Stockman from Oil Change International. There seems to be a race between Qatar, Australia, and the U.S. for title of the world's biggest gas exporter. For me, that's a race to the bottom, like who is the world's worst mass murderer or something. How can we counteract that terrible trend?
Well, we've been working to expose the damage that LNG does. It's very interesting, actually, just a couple of years ago, as the U.S. LNG industry was gearing up, the industry was pushing U.S. LNG as a clean fuel, a clean fossil fuel, and they were making claims about that that were unsubstantiated. And then something interesting happened in late 2020 when a French utility, Engie, which is partly owned by the French government, was in negotiations with a proposed LNG terminal in the Rio Grande terminal in Brownsville, Texas, which has tremendous opposition on the ground to it. And they pulled out of signing a long-term contract for the gas for LNG from that project over the amount of methane and greenhouse gas pollution that's associated with the Permian Basin in West Texas and New Mexico, where that plant would have sourced its gas. And that was a wake-up call for the U.S. oil and gas industry and the LNG industry. And suddenly we're seeing this industry coming up with all sorts of proposals to clean up its LNG. So what was supposed to be really clean to begin with is now, well, we can make that cleaner and we can compete in the global market saying ours is cleaner than others. And they're proposing carbon capture and storage facilities at the liquefaction plants where they turn the gas into a liquid to put onto ships. We're seeing claims of, you know, being able to trace the supply of gas and only buy from suppliers that have lower methane rates. All of this is an endeavor to kind of remain credible and remain relevant in a world that's decarbonizing. So, you know, our job is to expose the falsehoods behind that, to explain to customers in Asia and Europe that are in line to receive this LNG, whether it's from the U.S., Qatar, or anywhere, and explain that you can't really clean this stuff up to the level that is acceptable in a world that's transitioning to meet the Paris Agreement of 1.5 degrees. That's kind of the approach we're using, is to you know, shine a spotlight and fact check these claims and expose the fact that LNG is dirty, it was always dirty, and you can't really clean it up.
There was a wave of news stories declaring coal dead, or at least a dying industry. Some coal power stations did close, and several of the biggest American coal mining companies went bankrupt. But now the German group Urgewald reports big banks have laid out another $1.5 trillion on further coal growth just in the last 2 years. What are you hearing about this dirtiest of dirty fossil fuels?
Yeah, that's an extremely disturbing report from Urgewald, and we work with Urgewald in various ways. And that's right, you know, we're still seeing disinvestment, and it's extremely disturbing. We need to call out, as Urgewald is doing, and as we also do together with Urgewald and the partners like Rainforest Action Network and the Sierra Club, where we produce this Banking on Climate Chaos report annually, which adds up the finance that the banking sector is channeling towards fossil fuel industry. This is the completely wrong direction that the finance industry is going with coal and oil and gas. And we need to expose it and call it out and hold these banks to account.
Let's talk about my own country, Canada. Young Prime Minister Justin Trudeau paints himself as a world leader in the battle against climate change. But Trudeau spent over $4 billion of taxpayer money to purchase a tar sands pipeline that no private company would build. And we just learned, just in February, that the cost has soared to over $21.4 billion and counting. The cognitive dissonance between green talk and massive spending is so hard to take. What is your understanding about Canada?
You know, I think that's a fine example of, you know, the short-sightedness of politicians and what they feel they need to, the interest they feel they need to appease in order to get re-elected. It's very, very short-sighted. It's clear that the industry in Alberta in particular has asserted an incredible amount of pressure on the Trudeau government. It's extremely short-sighted. I'm certainly sympathetic and understand the position of workers and communities that have, you know, for decades been reliant on these industries. You know, and in Alberta, of course, you have a significant part of the economy that is historically been linked to oil and gas. But you know, the writing has been on the wall for decades now, and certainly in the last decade, it's become clearer than ever, and we need to see leaders who are prepared to stand up to the industry and to plan for a just and managed transition away from reliance on the fossil fuel economy. It's difficult. It's certainly a challenge and a threat to some communities and some group of workers. But I believe, you know, there are ways to manage that transition. We're not going to see those economies change overnight, but we should, you know, we should be further along at this point in planning to wind down those industries and replace those jobs with those that are not going to lead to the destruction of our climate system. It's extremely disappointing to see how the Trudeau government rescued the Trans Mountain pipeline. I think it's become increasingly clear that it was extremely foolish and a waste of public money. And the decision makers need to be held to account.
Lauren, we have radio stations in the UK where Prime Minister Boris Johnson is also warning about dangerous climate change, blah, blah, blah. But in late February, the UK's Energy Minister Greg Hands told an online energy conference, quote, "We need continued investment into the North Sea." It sounds like madness.
And indeed it is. And, you know, I think we've seen numerous studies and analysis coming out of some great climate advocates in the UK that show that this is just complete nonsense. The UK has actually done, a fairly good job of transitioning its power sector away from fossil fuels. Its wind, both onshore and offshore wind industry is one of the biggest in the world. And it can do a lot more and needs to be focused on that. Again, it's using the current crisis that we're seeing today as an excuse to carry on business as usual and further entrench the fossil fuel industry. It's very clear that that is not going to solve the problem long term in terms of the energy security problem. And, you know, the way to address energy security is to reduce your reliance on all fossil fuels as quickly as possible. President Putin or anyone else cannot use wind and solar as a weapon in the way that he's tried to use gas as a weapon in Europe or as a negotiating tool. But that's just something that's not going to happen when your reliance on oil and gas is definitively in decline. And that's what the UK and other European countries clearly need to do.
This is where renewable energy and the peace movement must get together. I mean, that's what we need.
I think that's right. And we see that happening in some places. But yeah, I mean, it's very clear that fossil fuels have been a catalyst for conflict, economic inequality, environmental injustice, environmental racism. For decades and decades, we've seen these problems, you know, whether it's the resource curse in countries like Nigeria or Venezuela. This stuff has been well understood, well known, well documented for a long time. And we've continued to see the entrenchment of the fossil fuel industry. You know, let's face it, it's an industry that's been around 100, 150 years. It's in almost every country in the world in one form or the other, either as a producer or as a distribution industry. And they are very adept at manipulating the politics and the policy making in many countries. We need to break the link between politics and the fossil fuel industry, or governance and the fossil fuel industry. And that's the case whether it's Canada, the US, Russia, or Nigeria. We've got to hold our politicians to account when they make decisions that are further entrenching fossil fuels into our economy.
Over a decade ago, you and Andy Roll wrote a book about London, Washington, and African oil. I see in the news the country of Niger plans to be a major oil and gas powerhouse, and Shell is busy with light oil off the coast of Namibia. It seems like the fossil disease has spread deeply into Africa. Is it too late to stop it and get solar and wind where they will really work well?
I don't think it is too late, no. I think these companies are doing what they've always done, but I see a growing movement in Africa pushing back on this. And there was, you know, a very insightful opinion piece in Foreign Policy magazine from Nemo Bassi, who has long been an activist in Nigeria, pushing back on what the industry's trying to do on the continent. We see study after study showing the best way to bring electricity to the hundreds of millions who don't yet have it on the African continent is to use decentralized distributed renewable energy. We see study after study showing that countries that are focused on extracting fossil fuels and exporting them don't have good results in terms of both economics and governance. So we're seeing a building movement. The next climate conference, the next COP, is on the African continent in Egypt. We're going to see a focus on climate in Africa and the energy transition in Africa at that conference. I know that the advocacy community, the climate community, is going to be pushing for that. So I certainly see building movement against that continued, the entrenchment of the extractive industry in Africa.
As we wrap up here, tell us about your organization, Oil Change International, and where to find you.
Sure, yeah. Oil Change International has been around since 2005. You can find us at priceofoil.org, priceofoil.org. We have been working to expose the true cost of fossil fuels and facilitate the transition to clean energy. As one of the only NGOs in, you know, exclusively focused on oil and gas, particularly on the public finance, the subsidies, as I mentioned earlier, you know, the influence of the fossil fuel lobby, its ability to extract public money to continue its operations. We're working all around the world now. We've grown to an organization on four continents, and we've been fighting the fossil fuel industry, and we will continue to do so.
From Washington, we have been speaking with Lauren Stockman, the research co-director at Oil Change International. Get links to the industry news you just heard in my show blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Get fossil fuel facts and some ways for resistance at priceofoil.org. Lauren, thank you for sharing with Radio EcoShock listeners.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Alex Smith.